Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, fire, fury, and North Korea. The president takes on Mitch McConnell, an opioid emergency, and the Google uproar. President Trump, off script, took the rhetoric up a big step this week on North Korea, and he's just kept escalating. Here was the first.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
News of an FBI raid at the home of the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, as part of the Russia investigation. ABC's Mary Bruce.
Before the sun came up, a dozen armed FBI agents were knocking at Paul Manafort's bedroom door, waking up Trump's former campaign chairman with a warrant to search his Virginia home.
And yesterday, President Trump called the opioid crisis a national emergency. It's certainly all over. At a news conference Monday, Nashville Mayor Megan Berry opened up about her son, who died of an overdose last month.
Our hearts will always be sad and empty because we can never replace our child.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with ABC News senior White House correspondent Cecilia Vega, Vox foreign editor Yoki Driesen, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you reassured by the president's tough talk on North Korea? Or terrified? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Cecilia Vega, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. She's been traveling with the president this week. He's been at his New Jersey golf club, but making plenty of headlines. Cecilia Vega, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
With us from Washington, Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor at Vox. Yoki Driesen, welcome back. Great to have you here today.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Cecilia, and Yoki.
The president of the United States turning everybody's heads midweek when he talked about fire and fury like the world has never seen coming down on North Korea. And then yesterday saying maybe that statement wasn't enough. Here he was back at the golf club.
Frankly, the people that were questioning that statement, was it too tough? Maybe it wasn't tough enough. They've been doing this to our country for a long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So, if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough.
Okay. And this morning, Yoki Driesen, the president is tweeting. This is 7:30 in the morning from the from Bedminster in the golf resort there. The tweet, military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. Should North Korea act unwisely, hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path. Yoki, where are we headed when the president of the United States just ratchets up and up?
So two things jumped out at me about that tweet. The first is conventional wisdom being wrong yet again. I mean, if you remember, there was the wave of stories after John Kelly, a retired general, was made chief of staff of the White House about how he would impose discipline. He would even manage to, in some small way, police Donald Trump's tweets. Not only has he failed to police tweets on things that are comparatively unimportant relative to nuclear war, like Trump's tweets bashing Mitch McConnell or bashing Senate Republicans, but he has totally failed to police any tweets of Donald Trump on an issue that very easily could lead to war. And it's important to recognize that Donald Trump right now is basically being baited in a way that his predecessors were not. He is right to say that North Korea is a terrifying threat. He's right to say that U.S. strategy, both parties that employed going back decades, has not worked. But Kim Jong-un and his predecessors love to sound tough. They love to put out something that's talking about apocalyptic attacks on the U.S., knowing that what that leads to is negotiations, concessions, and then dials back down again. Trump doesn't seem to realize that when he tweets something like this, he's playing into their hands. More importantly, the tweet that you flagged at the beginning is, like, unfortunately, like so much of what Donald Trump tweets, it's flat out a lie. I spent much of my career covering the Pentagon. Building up for a war against any country, but especially a country like North Korea, isn't something that you do in a week. It takes many months to move troops, to move airplanes, to move ships and boats and submarines. None of those things are happening. So when he says we have military solutions locked and loaded ready to go, that's simply a lie.
Cecilia Vega, have you spoken with White House staffers around the president about what he means by locked and loaded? This suggests ready to go.
Well, I will say this. The one thing I heard unanimously in covering this White House when John Kelly took this new job of chief of staff, if John Kelly, this retired four-star general, can't rein in Donald Trump, no one can. And we know after 7 months of this administration, Donald Trump speaks for himself. No one else does. So I'm not at all surprised by that tweet this morning. It's one of many that I think causes a lot of journalist consternation around the country when you're covering him, because it really is hard to make sense of what he means. Look, I think what we're seeing from President Trump right now is a phrase that I hate in using in covering this White House, doubling down. A lot of us thought he might back away from that stronger rhetoric, that fire and fury from the beginning of the week when we heard that he was going to be speaking before the cameras yesterday in Bedminster. The cameras came out. Donald Trump came out on that stair, those stairs right there, but with Mike Pence right by his side. And it was sort of bated breath as we were watching to wait to see what he would say, if he would back away. And he just ramped up that rhetoric and said, you know, maybe fire and fury wasn't tough enough. So there are as we all know from being inside Washington and watching this unfold, a lot of even the president's own allies saying you need to slow down here. This is really dangerous language, but that's not the strategy that this White House is taking. And in fact, they're sticking to it. And it doesn't look like I don't imagine that we're going to see a change in rhetoric. We're seeing instead this White House match North Korean rhetoric right word for word at this point.
If that constitutes a strategy. I mean, we had this sort of good cop, bad cop routine going on in the middle of the week. We had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, was flying back from Southeast Asia on Wednesday, telling Americans they could sleep well at night. Here he was.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea.
Well, that we had. And then another and another. And today these tweets saying the military solution's now fully in place, locked and loaded. Yoki Driessen says that's just not the case at this point, but language can have its own consequences. I mean, he was pressed on this yesterday. North Korea has said in this month it may test fire missiles toward or near the U.S. territory of Guam, where, of course, we have very strategic military installations. The president was asked about that at the golf course, at the golf resort, his golf resort in New Jersey yesterday.
He does something in Guam, it will be an event the likes of which nobody's seen before, what will happen in North Korea.
And when you say that, what do you mean?
You'll see. You'll see. And he'll see.
Is that a dare?
He will see. It's not a dare. It's a statement. It has nothing to do with dare. That's a statement. He's not going to go around threatening Guam, and he's not going to threaten the United States, and he's not going to threaten Japan, and he's not going to threaten South Korea. No, that's not a dare, as you say. That is a statement of fact.
That is a statement of fact. Yoki Driessen, what's factual here in terms of readiness? If the president says he's locked and loaded, could that mean we're not talking about conventional warfare? Could that mean nuclear? I mean, nuclear is super deadly, but simpler in some way, right? You press the button.
It is. I mean, if what he's saying is, I, as commander-in-chief, am ready to hit the button and give the order that leads to a nuclear strike, which would be unprecedented, really, in the history of the world, then yes, we have a piece up that went up Friday morning about how little stands in the way of an order from the president to the point where missiles fly. And basically, it's about 5 minutes from the time that the president decides to do so till when the missiles begin to fly out of submarines or silos or planes. So yes, if he's saying that I am prepared to use nuclear weapons and those are ready to go, that is true. But if that is what he means, that's utterly and completely terrifying. And some of the stuff, it's easy to talk about kind of coolly and analytically because it's so hard to get our arms around the idea of a nuclear strike. But the idea of a nuclear strike is so horrifying that we shouldn't lose sight of what that would mean. It would mean many millions of dead, not just in North Korea, but also in the South. It would mean the destruction of Seoul, the destruction of Tokyo in retaliation. And so if he does actually mean he's prepared to use nuclear weapons against North Korea, then this is a man who's prepared to cause millions of deaths based on what is, at least so far, threats from another country, but not actions from that other country.
Callers, lined up John in New York, Williamsville, New York. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, folks. Yeah, listen, I take a much different tack. We have been, if someone doesn't think that what we've been doing with North Korea has been appeasing them for decades, does not know the definition of the word. Over the last 7-8 months, they have not developed these weapons, these nuclear weapons. This has been going on for decades. All the while, we've been giving them money and saying we'll do this and take off sanctions. It doesn't work. These people only know an aggressive use of force as an antidote, and that's it. You know, we can talk to them. What are we going to talk to this guy about? He won't have face-to-face. No one can. We're going to send Dennis Rodham over there.
John, what do you think about the destruction of Seoul, the destruction of Tokyo maybe, millions dead, the world economy upside down?
It's hypothetical. That's hypothetical for one. Okay, we're thinking that they're going to just launch everything and they're not going to be any kind of retaliatory strike. That's insane. You know, this guy is ready there. He's talked about blowing up Guam. He unprovoked sends dozens of missiles to prove that he can do it. And we're just sitting there thinking, oh, Donald Trump's the crazy man because he says, yeah, you do something and we're going to follow it with something even worse. We've turned into an insane society.
John, we've got it. We've got it. Jack Beatty, you're watching all this. The president, you hear John there saying we've appeased long enough. The president says locked and loaded, and here the world stands.
Yes, I mean, what John's saying, people were saying that in the 1960s, as I remember, when the Chinese got the bomb. There was all this talk about, oh my God, this blood-curdling Mao, this terrible rhetoric, we have to strike now. We didn't. We resorted to deterrence and containment. It has worked vis-a-vis China. It worked vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
Are the same dynamics there with a regime like that in North Korea, Jack?
We don't know. We are told, and experts say, that Kim is rational, and his overriding rationality is to survive in office, which would be destroyed were he to follow through on any of this rhetoric.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, fire, fury in North Korea. The president takes on Mitch McConnell. The Manafort raid, an opioid national emergency, Google uproar, and more. Yoki Driesen is with us, foreign editor at Vox, deputy managing editor there. Cecilia Vega is with us, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. She's been with the president this week on his working vacation. Certainly plenty of headlines out of Bedminster, New Jersey, and the golf resort there. He is. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. What are you thinking on North Korea? The president's rhetoric? The American strategy? How do you see it here? Is there a strategy? Our first caller says, look, we've been at this for a long time. The president made that point yesterday in New Jersey.
They've been negotiating now for 25 years. Look at Clinton. He folded on the negotiations. He was weak and ineffective. You look what happened with Bush. You look what happened with Obama. Obama, he didn't even want to talk about it. But I talk. It's about time. Somebody has to do it.
Bruce in Iowa City. Bruce, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, very much. Very, very simple-minded remarks by the president, once again, that I just heard. And in general, President Trump's remarks, in my view, have been unsurprisingly and completely irresponsible. They're heartless and mindless and reflect really no foreign policy.
What do you think of the idea of North Korea having nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the United States?
I think that the policies that we've been upon, I mean, as I mentioned, his remarks about Bush and Obama, unrefined entirely. I don't see anything wrong with strategic patience, constantly looking for openings along the way to try to bring North Korea somehow back into the conversation. That would be the responsible way to proceed. I think that Obama did proceed responsibly in trying to reduce our tendency to constantly use our powerful armed forces.
Do you fear war, Bruce, or not?
Which leads to war. That has in the Vietnam War, whenever we rattled, all these disasters for the United States and those in other countries and regions stem from the United States' excessive use of power. It's been a disaster for our citizens, for those citizens.
Bruce, you've got it, and I appreciate your call from Iowa City. Cecilia Vega, can you describe to us the conversation that goes on in the White House now? I mean, we've seen the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, there at the president's side, but we also hear that Steve Bannon and McMaster have terrible relations. I don't know about exactly how the communication goes with Mattis at the Pentagon now. When the president made these first remarks, he was flanked by the Health and Human Services Secretary, by Kellyanne Conway, and by Melania Trump. Well, who's in the inner circle of this?
You know, it depends on the day of the week right now, I think. We'll look at the shakeup that we saw last week inside this White House with a six-day-on-the-job communication director out, chief of staff out, Sean Spicer out, new people likely to come in. This has been a West Wing that has just been rife with knives in people's backs since the day I started covering it, during the transition. That is just, there is a constant source of angst and fighting and infighting.
Yeah, but at a certain point, that was kind of maybe even amusing. But when potential war is on the table, it's certainly not. So who decides? Who's in there?
There are two divided camps right now, and we saw this unfold in real time this week with this fire and fury comment that the president made. There very much is a strategy and an open, constant conversation that I'm told and the sources that I've talked to that happened in the West Wing to up the ante, to increase the rhetoric, to speak the same language that Kim Jong-un is speaking, and to have the president, if he was going to be asked about North Korea, they knew he would be, to come out swinging on North Korea. What happened was, what we've since learned, is that fire and fury comment was a little bit off cuff. This was not a scripted comment. It caught aides, including General Kelly, the chief of staff, by surprise. So I think here's the question. Even if there is a strategy, and there is one, is this a script that a president who is known for going off script all the time can stick to and deliver this message that those in the White House want him to deliver and need him to deliver? Can he do it?
I mean, fire and fury, like the world has never seen, suggests nuclear, and that gets everybody's attention. Doug in, here's nuclear territory, Los Alamos, New Mexico. Doug, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a retired nuclear physicist. I've worked with quite a few people, both from North and South Korea. I've not been to the North. I have been to the South. I know quite a bit about the nuclear program of the North, of the USA. I agree with Secretary of State Tillerson. One should sleep easy, but it scares the deuce out of me when I listen to President Trump. Nuclear weapons and their use are just terrible. It's not something to joke. He's not joking. It's not something to threaten. That's my comment.
Do you feel as though it's been threatened this week, Doug?
Yes. And the people, I don't believe continental USA is threatened by the North, but the southern neighbors, Korea, or not, but Japan and other islands like Guam. That scares me. And from what I know of international law, he can launch his four missiles, and if they land into international waters near Guam, that's okay in some sense. It's a test.
Yeah. I mean, we've certainly done plenty of tests over the years, but what a context. What a context now. Doug, I appreciate your call from Los Alamos. I mean, Yoki Driessen, how do you see you say that there's a 5-minute space between a president's decision and, you know, bombs away on the nuke front, but we want to believe that when the chips are really down, there'll be a serious conversation about what happens here. Where will that or will that happen?
You know, there's no question that if Donald Trump, we know already about him that he is easily persuaded, that often the last person he speaks to is the person who's opinion he ultimately parrots back and whose policy preference he then adopts. There's no question in my mind whatsoever that if he was leaning that way, John Kelly, H.R. McMaster, James Mattis, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Jim Dunford, Rex Tillerson, possibly even people who are somewhat less versed in national security like Jared Kushner, would all be telling him he cannot and should not do this. It's very possible they'd be able to talk him down. It's also possible, frankly, I don't think this is probable or likely, but I do think it is possible that he would give the order and it would not be carried out. Under the Code of Military Justice, troops do not have to carry out orders if they believe them to be illegal or to violate the laws of war. Arguably, a nuclear strike on a country that has not attacked the U.S. would be both illegal and a violation of the act of war.
But Donald Trump knows how to say, you're fired. Couldn't he just keep doing that until he finds a soldier who hits the button?
He could. He could. But you can also have a situation, and again, I'm not saying that this is remotely the probable outcome, but if he ignores his entire national security cabinet, every single person who tells him, do not do this, it is possible that he gives the order, and if it's ignored, he has to keep trying to find people in that specific place who will do it. And you're right, he could fire 20, 50, 100 officers till he finds one who's willing to go that route, but there would be a lot of pushback against his decision to try to do this. That said, the nightmare scenario in my mind is the following. North Korea carries through with its threat to fire on Guam. They've threatened this before.
Near Guam. They threatened, well, I guess they threatened both, but
they threatened to hit Guam yeah. specifically, but yes, in this current case, you're right. They've threatened to fly and hit the waters near Guam with, mm-hmm. within about 25 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So let's assume for the second they go ahead and do that. And in the past, they've talked about it and not done it. But let's assume
to be fair,
they do.
That's super provocative because that's a major U.S. base. This is not joking around.
100%. This base houses 6,000 U.S. troops, large numbers of U.S. aircraft, large numbers of U.S. family members of U.S. troops.
Yep.
So let's say this missile is launched and it's not precise. North Korean missiles have not always yep. landed where they're supposed to, and it actually hits Guam. In that case, all bets are off. All pushback against doing something significant to North Korea, probably not nuclear, but something significant. Suddenly Donald Trump will feel like I was attacked, I'm justified in hitting back, and then all bets are off. So to me, the nightmare scenario is something we may discover whether it happens very soon. Step one, North Korea fires it. Step two, the missile lands where it's not supposed to. Step three, it's some sort of war.
Wow. Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Guam is 2,000 miles away from North Korea. And if you look at the radius, so anybody in that 2,000-mile radius is in jeopardy. But the global news, Chinese global news, has said they will be neutral if North Korea strikes first. I wonder what that means. And the second thing is China sitting back and letting the U.S. do their dirty work of some kind?
That is an interesting question. I'll bring it to you, Yoki, first. But what about China in all this? I mean, at what point do they come in? At any point do they come in and change the reality in North Korea?
So it's been very interesting. Chinese rhetoric towards North Korea has been getting harsher and harsher almost by the day. And there's been a very significant change. Rhetoric for North Korea and China matters a lot because China is its biggest trading partner, its most important ally. And China has been telling North Korea, do not do this. And China has allowed through, as Donald Trump mentioned in a previous tweet, unanimous Security Council sanctions against North Korea. In the past, China has had tended to veto or block those. So China is getting more and more aggressive in saying to North Korea, don't do this, and getting angrier and angrier that North Korea is pretty much ignoring what China is telling it to do. I don't think we will get to a point where China threatens military action or uses military force, but it is correct, and perhaps this is something Donald Trump meant to have happen, or maybe it's just a positive outcome of it. But China is getting much harsher in what it says about and what it does towards North Korea.
Jack, I want to get to you one more call here. Kathy in Medina, Ohio. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My question is this whole thing just seemed to have started with the announcement by the one intelligence agency about the nuclear capabilities of North Korea.
That's right, saying that they had miniaturized their nuclear warheads and they had missiles that could strike the United States.
Right, and this is the same agency apparently that got it wrong 4 years ago in the past. Has there been any more, proof of this in any of the other countries or intelligence agencies? Just wondering if this is all just kind of a staged thing, I hate to be so conspiracy
stage for what
about it stage to help ratings and pull and, you know, get people on board with Trump and worry about war. And so, you know, I mean, I'm just wondering if what's the proof that they have these capabilities and what's the possibility that this is all just a, you know, another one of his tactics.
Yeah, we got it. Yoki, very quickly, this was the Defense Intelligence Agency, I believe, who put this out. Should we feel confident that they've got it right?
If anything, I think we should feel worried that they are not accurate enough in assessing how dangerous North Korea is. When the U.S. has gotten it wrong with North Korea, it isn't Iraq. It isn't that they thought North Korea had something they didn't have. It's they thought North Korea didn't have something they actually did have.
Mm-hmm. So, Thought this was years off, and presto, here it is.
Exactly. So I think if we're going to worry, we should worry the opposite direction from what the caller had been suggesting.
Jack Beattie, there's a lot on the table here. Step back. What do you see going on with this president, these threats, the tension between North Korea and the United States now, this whole picture and the country, much of the world potentially, could be the brink of war?
Yes. And, you know, it has a prehistory with Donald Trump. I mean, the campaign exposed his ignorance about nuclear weapons. He didn't know the triad from a cord of wood. The campaign...
sea-based, air-based, silo-based.
He just blathered about it when he was asked about it. And Joe Scarborough reported that a foreign policy expert met with Trump during the campaign, and in the course of an hour, the president three times asked, if we have these nuclear weapons, why can't we use them? A sort of insouciance about Armageddon. And you know, the campaign also saw 50 former officials of the national security setup of GOP administrations predicting that Trump would be the most reckless president in U.S. history. Indeed, we are convinced, these 50 GOP national security experts said, we're convinced he would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's well-being. This rhetoric is doing just that. And, you know, you look at it and you think, well, what can we do? The whole question of nukes and what people have been asking about it. Well, there is a bill in Congress. It was introduced last year. It's called the No First Use Act. Last year, when it looked like Hillary was going to win, it was introduced. And basically, it would say, if you want to use a first strike, you've got to come to Congress and ask. And that's an effort to square up our Constitution with the nuclear age and to say that Congress has the power to declare war. A first strike of nuclear weapons is war if nothing is. You've got to come to Congress for that. That bill, is something to rally around, not just against this president, but certainly against him, but against future presidents. And it doesn't affect the whole idea of deterrence, because, of course, deterrence is the reply, a second strike.
We've got more to look at here, but Cecilia Vega, what, if anything, talks the president back down, or does he just continue to escalate? And if so, where does that end?
Well, I think the comments that he made yesterday in Bedminster were really telling. He was asked if negotiations are a possibility. He said, yes, negotiations are a possibility. He was asked if a preemptive strike is a possibility. He said, I'm not going to telegraph to you what we're going to do. I think everything is on the table right now. I don't think you're going to see a softening of this language, but I think the biggest question hanging over this White House today is, what exactly is the red line for Donald Trump? Is it a threat to Guam? The North Koreans did that. They made that threat. Is it an actual attack? Is preemptive strike a real possibility? We don't know the answers to those questions yet.
AP just reporting that a senior U.S. diplomat has been engaged in back-channel diplomacy with North Korea for several months now, contacts ongoing. Yoki, maybe this is just raising the temperature in a negotiation.
You know, the thing that North Korea has asked for many years has been direct talks with the U.S. I mean, they want the optics and the images, frankly, of Kim Jong-un shaking hands with an American president or with an American secretary of state, sitting down like equals in a hotel room. They desperately want that, because that validates that they're a legitimate government, a government we recognize, a government we're not trying to overthrow. Previous presidents have not been willing to do it. It is possible that Donald Trump, who fancies himself a master dealmaker, would be willing to do it. That would be an amazingly smart thing, frankly, because no matter where those talks go, the fact they'd be happening would mean we're not going to be bombing them anytime soon. And I think that's an important question that I'm glad has been raised. Will Donald Trump be willing to do that? Would he be willing to break with his predecessors? Would he be willing to put his credibility on the line in some way? It would, to my mind, be the smartest thing he could do at this particular point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, pumps out of service, a heavy rain, and water rising in the streets of New Orleans. Here's resident Naaman Stewart at a New Orleans City Council meeting.
If we flood like this in a typical New Orleans summer rainstorm, what's going to happen in a hurricane?
Yeah, watch out. Late night host Stephen Colbert took on President Trump's high rhetoric on North Korea.
Thankfully, faced with the greatest challenge of his presidency, Donald Trump stepped up and, in a moment of pure statesmanship, de-escalated the rhetoric and brought calm to our worried nation. I'm just kidding.
And Glenn Campbell died at 81 after battling Alzheimer's disease. The singer, songwriter, TV host, and actor released more than 60 albums, sold 45 million records, scored 9 number one hits over his legendary career.
Like a rhinestone cowboy, riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo.
We're looking at a week in the news, fire, fury in North Korea, the president takes on Mitch McConnell, the Manafort raid, an opioid national emergency, Google uproar, and more. Cecilia Vega is with us, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. Yoki Driessen is here, deputy managing editor, foreign editor at Vox. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Do you see the opioid crisis as a national emergency? The words the president used yesterday. When the FBI raids Paul Manafort's home, no knock. Where are we headed? And how are you sizing up Google and its struggle over gender and tech? What are you thinking on the Minnesota mosque, Kenya's elections, Glenn Campbell? Cecilia, I want to ask you about the president this week going after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He did it earlier in the week and again yesterday at a press briefing. He's criticizing McConnell for the Senate's failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
They said, Mitch, get to work and let's get it done. They should have had this last one done. They lost by one vote. For a thing like that to happen is a disgrace. And frankly, it shouldn't have happened. That I can tell you.
It's a disgrace. Pretty tough language there. Newt Gingrich on Fox News yesterday said, come on, you've got to share the blame for this. The president is in on it. Here was Gingrich.
The president can't disassociate himself from this. He's part of the leadership team. He's not an observer sitting up in the stands. He's on the field. It was a collective failure. Both the Trump administration and the Republicans in the Senate failed. But to get involved in shooting at each other, when there were 16 Democrats voting no for every single Republican who voted no, is goofy.
Cecilia Vega, the president has a lot he'd like to get done. He hasn't got much done on Capitol Hill. Can he afford to alienate Mitch McConnell? Does this amount to alienation?
Well, you asked if this is a war or a feud. I mean, I think this is an outright war, and the president is willing to go publicly after the majority leader. The potential problem with that, right, is that you've got a majority leader who is very popular among his colleagues who are in control in Congress, and the president very much needs them down the road to, if he is going to be able to get any legislative victory under his cap after health care failed, you know, he's looking at them for tax reform. He'll be looking at them for infrastructure. He's going to need them to be on his side. He is not in any way endearing himself to those like Lindsey Graham, like Orrin Hatch, who are in McConnell's camp. Here's the issue, though. The question is whether McConnell needs Donald Trump, because right now the president is polling higher than those in Congress. Those 2018 midterms are right around the corner. McConnell's people seem to sort of be willing to let this one go in public. Donald Trump, though, is not backing down, and he's really just beating down McConnell, and it's almost like he feels like he's willing to go at it alone and stick to this notion that he's rogue, he's an outsider, he's not a Washingtonian, and he's going to bash even those who should be his friends in Congress. And very much, again, part of that Donald Trump strategy as I'm not a Washingtonian, look at me, I'm different, and I'm going to take these guys on too.
Jack, how do you see this unfolding? Mitch McConnell does not seem like the forgive and forget type. On the other hand,
Maybe the president can just bull his way through here if his numbers stay. I mean, there are problems with them, but if they're stronger than those on Capitol Hill, maybe he's got the leverage.
Yes, who would have thought you could find somebody that's weaker in the polls than the president? But yes, he's got the media that's way down there, and he's got Congress. You know, I just want to second what Newt Gingrich said. I mean, the president should look in the mirror. He's the man who, I think, in the space of 4 days, or maybe it was 3 days, had four different positions on health care, announced them at various times. He's the person who, in meetings with the Congress, could not explain what was in his own bill, had no comprehension of what Trump care was. He's the person who, after he had the White House celebration, you know, of the House passing Trump care, he turned around, he said, well, it's too cruel, after he'd gone on. His incoherence, his ignorance, his bluster, as much as anything else, helped to doom the efforts the Republicans were doing.
Can I ask about the raid on Manafort's home? Now, this is news that just came out this week, but that last month the FBI went in with a search warrant. It was a no-knock raid, Cecilia. That means it was kind of middle of the night. I mean, into his bedroom, no prior notice, I guess, means they were worried that he wouldn't cooperate or might get rid of documents. I guess that there's a suggestion in that. What does it say about where Robert Mueller's investigation stands that this has taken place, Cecilia?
Yeah, it was early in the morning. A dozen FBI agents pounded on his front door, and we're told he was sound asleep inside when this happened at his home in Virginia. Even, you know, the president and his inner circle were surprised that this had happened. What it means is that this investigation from Mueller's camp is taking a much more public turn. This is the first time we've seen anything along the lines of a search warrant, which, let's just remind ourselves here that in order to obtain a search warrant, you've got to go to a judge. You've got to have some probable cause, and you've got to get a sign off on it. So there was evidence there, at least that they presented to a judge, to get this warrant to go inside this house. What it means, though, is that Manafort and his team have maintained all along that he's been cooperating, providing documents.
Who's he? Manafort, you mean?
Manafort, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. that Manafort and his team have been mm-hmm. cooperating all along, handing over documents in the hundreds that have been asked of him, giving investigators everything that they need. But the reality is, these investigators, these agents would not have pounded on that front door if he was cooperating to the level that they need him to be cooperating to, that they want him to be cooperating to, and gone inside and taken what they needed. So there are big questions that are coming to light for us, those of us who are covering this story, about whether Manafort is cooperating as much as he says he is.
But is he the one, Yoki, is he the one who was talking, for example, about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians last summer?
You know, I think that's one of the big questions. You know, is the strategy that Mueller has to start flipping people potentially, like Manafort, like Flynn, to try to get them to be scared enough that they then do try to kick up information about Jared Kushner, about Donald Trump Jr., possibly about Donald Trump himself? In terms of the no-knock raid, I think part of it may have been that they genuinely worried he might try to erase files or erase computers. Frankly, I think much more likely is that they just wanted to have the optics and send the message of, this is a serious, serious thing. We're not going to hold back. We'll do the same things to somebody as wealthy as Paul Manafort in Trump Tower as we would against a lower-level drug dealer who lives in a small town someplace. I think it was for show, but I think it was for show for a purpose. And I think that purpose is they want to see if they can either convict him or convict him and flip him, or get him to really give up stuff in exchange for not being put on trial. Mm-hmm. So if I were Donald Trump, I would be terrified about this raid.
Here was the president. Yes, Cecilia. Quickly,
I think it's also to send a message to the others who are inside this investigation or being investigated, perhaps Don Jr., perhaps some others in the president's inner circle, to say, if we're going to go after a guy like Paul Manafort, we would come after you too, so you better be cooperating with our investigators when they come and make that phone call to you.
This was the president yesterday on the Manafort raid, again, talking from his golf club in New Jersey.
Whether or not it was appropriate, you'd have to ask them. I've always found Paul Manafort to be a very decent man. And he's like a lot of other people, probably makes consultant fees from all over the place. Who knows? I don't know. But I thought that was a very, that was pretty tough stuff.
Mr. President,
to wake him up, perhaps his family was there. I think that's pretty tough stuff.
Pretty tough stuff, said the president. But that's not all he talked. He talked about a lot of things yesterday. Among the other things was Moscow, Vladimir Putin, saying that the U.S. Embassy in Moscow has to cut its staff there by 755 members in just the next few weeks here, kind of an astonishing drawdown. But the president was flippant about that yesterday, saying, hey, thanks, Mr. Putin, for helping us cut back on our payroll. Here was the president of the United States talking about the kind of gutting of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow.
I want to thank him because we're trying to cut down on payroll. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very thankful that he let go of a large number of people because now we have a smaller payroll. There's no real reason for them to go back. So I greatly appreciate the fact that they've been able to cut our payroll for the United States. We'll save a lot of money.
Cecilia, what's the president doing there? Is he being facetious? Is he saving face? Is he serious?
I'm sorry to tell you, I can't be your President Trump whisperer on this one. Yeah. I wish I could. Look, I don't know if he was being sarcastic. I don't know if he was being facetious. It's the first time that he's talked about this issue of 755 embassy staffers being expelled.
And that's the first thing he has to say. I mean,
and he thanks Vladimir Putin for it. I do know that it's largely raised eyebrows and being seen as a pretty bizarre answer. But I don't know if he was joking or not in that one.
Jack, what do you think of that?
And he was wrong, by the way. Experts just quoted, I was watching CNN this morning, they had people formerly from the State Department who said, no, in fact, we have to keep paying people. So it's not like that isn't even saving money. And it's a grotesque comment, really, if he meant it. And if it's a joke, well, think what that does to the morale of people in the Foreign Service whose lives are quite, you know, as Incidents in Cuba puts out, whose well-being and lives are at stake every day. And he just makes this this blithe comment, it goes on, and the bromance with Putin goes on and continues to just it puzzles eternity.
Kind of wild news from Cuba this week, yes, about these embassy staffers there who have had severe hearing loss. Speculation some kind of snooping device by the Cubans may have caused that, but. Yoki Driessen, I just don't know what to say about the president on this front. Look, they're cutting the State Department right and left. Maybe it is indeed just in line with his policy.
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that he has proposed cutting the State Department right or left, and the response on Capitol Hill from the Republicans was, this is dead on arrival. So
Okay. He's
proposed cutting it by 30%, and that's not going to go anywhere. I think what's scarier is the number of jobs that are unfilled. So we don't, for instance, have an ambassador in South Korea. We don't have an ambassador in Japan. We don't have the top Asia policy officials at either the Pentagon or the State Department or the National Security Council. So he's leaving key jobs open when we most desperately need them. And in all honesty, I thought that comment was not quite as scary as North Korea stuff, but almost as scary.
Why? What do you mean?
Because it was one of two things. It's either total, complete ignorance in a way that is offensive beyond measure to a State Department that already feels battered around, ignored, and derided, or it is yet another example of him trying to curry favor with Vladimir Putin when he is the only person in the entire Trump administration who still denies that Russia meddled. Every other member of that administration, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, Mike Pompeo, the CIA chief, James Mattis, Rex Tillerson, without exception, every member of that administration openly says that Russia was meddling and they need to be punished. The only person who won't say that is Donald Trump. So if this was meant seriously, if, you know, Jack is right that this is factually wrong, it's not that this actually saves the U.S. any money, but setting that aside, if he actually meant this as sort of some kind of weird thank you / praise of Vladimir Putin, it again underscores the question, the only big meta question hanging over Donald Trump, which is why? Why does he continue to suck up to Vladimir Putin when the rest of his own administration sees Putin as a threat? When Congress ties his hands because they're worried he will try to lift sanctions on Russia that they don't want to see lifted, why does he keep doing things Putin wants him to do?
Yeah. I've got to ask about the president's comments yesterday on the opioid situation in this country. He was asked by his panel to declare a national emergency about this earlier, didn't do it. But then yesterday, just kind of casually on the porch at his golf resort, here's what he had to say.
The opioid crisis is an emergency, and I'm saying officially right now it is an emergency. It's a national emergency. We're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money on the opioid crisis.
Cecilia, is that it? He says, I'm saying it officially, but is that the formal declaration of a national emergency? What is it?
Well, there was a little bit of a head scratcher for everybody because we actually expected that to happen, the real official signing, at least, to happen earlier in the week, and it didn't. But, you know, look, this is an issue that the president campaigned on very heavily. He talked a lot about it during the campaign, and then he created this commission, and there were missed deadlines to give the president updates on its status, multiple missed deadlines, if you will. The president had been hammered hard, especially by Democrats, for not doing enough. You'll remember, I think it was last week, it all sort of blurs together sometimes, when those leaked transcripts of the phone calls between the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Australia, where the president bashed the state of New Hampshire, calling it a drug den. So this is an issue that has hung over his head, and he's been criticized for not doing enough. I think this was the point where he finally had to do something and come out in public and say it. But this, just to circle back to where we started, you know, this press conference was like a who's who of topics, if you will. It was like he'd sort of been pent up and had a lot to get off of his chest, and there was an aide standing in that room saying last question, and the president just kept looking at the press that was in there and said, and he kept going. So opioids was clearly on that list. I want to correct myself quickly because it wasn't a press conference. This is just a minor technical thing. It was a pool report, a group of poolers, a smaller portion of the White House press conference. But he went there, and it had been months since we'd heard from him on this front to this length and an extent. But again, no opioids. He declared it an official declaration, but I, to my knowledge, I don't think there's been a signing of one yet. Well, that may have happened, and I don't know it.
Heavens knows, many, many, many American families afflicted with this, and we'll be watching to see just how seriously this is taken. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Cecilia Vega, senior White House correspondent for ABC News. Cecilia, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yoki Driesen at Vox. Thank you very much, Yoki.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We go out once more with Glenn Campbell. Here's his 1968 Wichita lineman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.